All right, today is Thursday, January 25th, 2024. My name is Sarah Schneider, and I'm joined by Gail J. Gibson. We are conducting the second session of an oral history interview with Patsy S. Chapelier at her home in Houston, Texas. So we're looking forward to continuing the conversation again today. And Gail, I think you had a question about Rice, so if you want to start off with that, that would be great.
So your time at Rice University, you graduated with a BA in chemical engineering, but then later...
And then a BS.
Can you talk a little more about what that difference was and what was going on?
It's the name of the degree. The study plan at that time at a lot of the major universities was either 4 years in a summer or a five-year program. And in other words, it was thought that it took that much time to prepare somebody for a career in chemical engineering. Of course, what we had to study was based on what people were learning in a regular high school in the United States, which I went to a so-called regular high school. So you did not know anything about calculus. That was the vast majority of the high school graduates at the time that I graduated. And to do engineering, you have to be able to handle a lot of higher mathematics. That was the biggest influence on why it took so long. The other thing is the curriculum. For engineering, there's two philosophies. One is you cram people as full as you can of theory, and the other one is you cram them as full as you can of hands-on experience. Rice was cramming full of theory institute, and it was their philosophy. So they were cramming us as full as they could of theory. And I found out that our program was the equivalent of a master's at many other universities. Is that what you wanted to know?
Yeah, and was there additional coursework then to get a BS?
Oh, I went through 5 years of taking four or five major, four is considered a full curriculum.
Okay.
I had five for 5 years.
Okay.
So I took 3 years of chemistry. I took 2 years of physics. I took 3 years of mathematics. I took a year of... In 5 years, I had two semesters that I could make a free elective. Okay? And if you look at your curricula for almost every other, you have a lot more choice than that.
Okay.
Does that...
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So typically when universities today would offer a BS, that's more of the cram full of experience plus some theory in your view? Or?
It depends on the university. I think universities have personalities. And there's a great deal of difference in a research university. And I'm seeing my daughters working at a community college, and their philosophy is quite different. They are trying to bring people who are not from a non-university background in their families. Many, many of her students, you know, they are the first people in their family to graduate from high school. Many of her students have English as a second language. Many of them are already parents and have small children to take care of. Many of them have full-time, 40-hour-a-week jobs. So it's a different from your, I'm straight out of high school, I'm 17 or 18 years old, and I go to college type of, and I was always expected to go to college background. So the different people, you have to tailor your education for that group of people.
Now, you've talked before about sort of, I guess some would call a capstone, sort of the design class,
design
sort of bring
class.
It all together. Was that as part of the BS, that last
That's
year?
That's the last year.
Okay.
The capstone course. And you finally are able to, well, and I think I showed you my first consulting job that I did with Professor Kobayashi when I was, remember I had just graduated in June, 1st of June, and I did this the following, I met John and got married, so we did that. I was very, I only had 1 year out since I had earned my degree. And yet that's a very complete design. And I did most of the actual work.
Oh, yeah. It's a good way to culminate all those theoretical
things. Yes, and this is, the work that we did for our design course wasn't nearly as complete as this in school, but I had that experience. I had, you know, been around for a year now working at Shell first, and then I was able to integrate it and do this.
Were a lot of your fellow students ending their studies with the BA, or did many?
Oh, no, nobody ended with the BA.
Okay.
No, the ones, once we got past that, entered into our junior year, there were about 24, 25 of us, and we all made it through. The ones who were weeded out in the freshman and sophomore years.
Okay. So you graduated with this degree, and you had talked, I think, yesterday about applying to positions, and I was wondering, I think you talked about this a little bit yesterday, but if you could refresh my memory, were you considering graduate school right after graduation at all? Or
no, not at all.
Okay.
No, I did not consider graduation at all. It had really, I had the brother 15 months younger than I, and it had really, I knew how hard a strain it had been on my parents to have two children in college at the same time. And my brother also worked, you know, we worked as much as we could to help pay for our things. When he was a student at A&M, he had a paper route, for instance.
What does that refer to?
Oh, you don't know what a paper route is.
Oh, a paper route. Oh,
a
I'm
paper,
sorry.
A paper
I misheard
route.
You. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay, okay.
Yes. So he got up. And he was in the Corps. It's a funny story. I love funny stories. But he was very dark hair and a very heavy beard. And so he got up and shaved and ran his paper route and then had to stand inspection at 8 a.m. like all the guys in the Corps had to. And some mornings they would send him back home to shave again because his beard had grown so bad.
Oh my gosh.
Poor Don. Some ways we ladies have advantages.
On that.
Okay, so you knew you were applying to positions, and you talked a little bit about that yesterday, the process of, you know, deciding where you wanted to be. And so when you started at Shell, how was that initial transition? Do you remember anything about those first days of working there, and how did you adapt to the new environment? What were your thoughts about the work, you know, when you... just at the very beginning?
Well, the first thing, in Houston, transportation is a real thing. Now, I actually had a car, but of course I wanted to get away from my parents as soon as possible, and so I rented a very small apartment, and of course I wanted to be where everything was going on, so I got it down close to the university in the center of Houston. I had a garage apartment behind somebody's house. And so the first thing I did was find somebody who was also commuting from Central Houston and get in a carpool. And that was very important. Let's see, the first days, just like everybody else, we had to go through and take out a time card and punch the time card, although we were salaried people, so we didn't get paid overtime. But we had to do that to control the number of people so they knew this is a safety, common safety, how many people are here, when, so we know what to do, because a refinery is a dangerous place. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, and I may say this several times, every time I speak to a group of people who are attempting to go into science and engineering, I tell them the most important part of their job is safety. Mm-hmm. And I have yet to meet an engineer who doesn't nod their heads when I say that. And it is important. If you see a pen, a writing pen, on the floor, pick it up. Somebody might trip over it. Okay? That's the beginning of safety.
Just, can I ask a little bit on that? Did you learn some of that in university, or was that really instilled in you later?
No, I did not get that at the university, looking back. not in a direct sense of somebody coming out and saying it, you know. I'm sure that there were certain things that you did unconsciously, but none of the professors ever brought this out, as far as I can remember.
And what kinds of safety measures did you have at the Deer Park Refinery, and was that part of your initial training?
I really don't remember. Part of initial training. Yes, it is. Smoking. I smoked at that time, which most people, if you didn't smoke when you went to college, you took it up when you were in college because it was how we rebelled. So you couldn't smoke in just any place in the refinery because of the danger. So you had specific spots to go if you wanted to smoke, and you had to go to that location to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason I quit smoking, because it was too difficult to smoke in the diary.
Yeah.
For a while there, I went off and on with my smoking.
Mm-hmm. So, aside from the safety, did you have other kinds of training that you received at the beginning of your position?
I don't remember any formal training program the Shell had at that time. They did have some sort of a program in mind, looking back on what our assignments were, and I can tell that they did. But, you know, when you're being the victim of the training and they're trying to train you without you being known that you're knowing that you're being trained, it's hard to recognize what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time to talk with the guys that had been there and doing things for, and finding out what they were doing. And it's like being a graduate student talking to all the other graduate students about what are you doing, what are you investigating. If that's a training program, that's the training program I had.
Hmm.
Were they encouraged to spend time with new hires?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yes, I think so. We didn't have to account, it's pretty strange looking back at it. I didn't have to account for my time on an hourly basis like a new lawyer has to do. I had a specific project I was assigned to, and I worked on that project.
Can you talk a little about your supervisor?
His name was Stan Marble. And in later years, he said that when I married my husband, a show man, and one of us had to quit, he said the wrong one quit. So I think he liked me. That's all I remember about him. I had the impression he was very helpful and very, very glad to know me, and he apparently thought I did a good job, and, you know, I was getting good. I got a good review, whatever review I had after a few months, and he was sorry to see me leave. So, but I was only with Shell 6 months, so that's a short period.
And in that 6 months, was there things that really kind of turned you on, or that you really didn't like?
No, it was all new and exciting and interesting and everything. I think I'm trying to describe the situation at Shell. The group that I was in was called the research group, and we had a large pilot plant building, and I was in the pilot plant building, which was in charge of the lubricating oils and the heavy processing portion. And then there was another larger laboratory with a reception area where we could go to smoke, and the head of the lab and the other areas investigating other parts of the to refine petroleum. You come in and there's a lot of different blocks that, like we were talking about yesterday, and so you have to have all of the different blocks have all of their different specialties. To the end, you have a lot of products that you make, so you've got some people that their job is that end product, that in, and they've got all of these pieces that they've got to take care of, manage their shipment out and handling them. And that is a specialty area. But the petroleum comes in, it's all mixed up together. So the first thing you got to do is separate into a lot of things. And then each one of these things you have to make into something useful. And one of them ends up being jet fuel, one ends up being automobile fuel, one ends up as lubricating oils, one ends up as tar to put on your road. So every one of these is a subspecialty of the refining process. And in the research group, we had people that were specialists in all of these subgroups, and I was assigned to the lube oils section.
And so what, could you describe sort of a day doing that, doing your work at Shell? What was it like? What were you doing throughout the day?
Well, the first thing I did was a lot of reading, because I had to find out exactly what the details were about how you process the lubricating oils and the heavy fractions. And then I had to study about the particular treatment thing that I was investigating in the podbiliac extraction. That is a particular chemical process, extraction. And it has all of its own nuances. Like catalysis is a specialty area. There's a whole field of interest in catalysis. And if you've studied that, you know that. And I didn't study it, so I don't know very much about it. But you have to really, when you have a new assignment in any aspect of chemistry or chemical engineering, you have to, first of all, find out what is known about this subject. And then I had to find out about the particular piece of equipment that I was charged with and learning it. And then I actually designed and got the, figured out, well, we're going to try this experiment to find out, and so on, and had to plan. So you have to do a lot of planning. I did that. And then we would have coffee hour. That was important.
What would you talk about during coffee hour?
Oh, all sorts of things. You know, how the Astros are, they weren't the Buffaloes in those days. That's the baseball team. And that sort of thing. And I was the only woman, of course, in the group. And so they were very interested in me. And of course, I was, you know, fresh out, bright young thing. All the men around, I guess their testosterone was really hitting the ceiling. But I was sort of oblivious to it. So they, of course, got very interested. And after I'd been there about 3 months, they got brave and said, "What do you want in a husband?" So I thought about it, and one of them wrote down my requirements. And I ended up with about 30 items. Everything from, I wanted him to be, from, you know, maybe 1 year younger to maybe 4 or 5 years older than me, or 2 years. At some point, I wanted him to be taller than me. I wanted him to be in an engineering scientific training. I wanted him to like to play bridge. I wanted him to like going to the live theater and live symphony. And I didn't want him to be a Yankee. Remember, I'm from Texas. let's see, what were the... I wanted him to be close to my religion that I had grown up in. And on and on. Anyway, I had this long list of things. Well, my husband, of course, everybody's got to tell their story. But this is... John had finished his doctorate at Indiana University in theoretical physics. And he had taken a job with Shell, but he was with Shell Development Company. And he was working in Houston, and their laboratory was in on Holcomb Boulevard or Bellar Boulevard. It had two names. And it was right next to Southside Place, which is a very small city enclosed in Houston. But I think it was actually in Houston, and it was before you got to Bel Air. That's where the laboratory was. So I worked for Shell Refinery Company, in Deer Park. Mm-hmm. And Deer Park is a suburb, separate city from Houston, and it's 10 miles from the center of the city, roughly. And then his office was maybe two or three miles from the center of the city to the east, and Deer Park was to the south. So we were physically really far away from each other. But we both played bridge. We had both learned to play and enjoyed playing bridge. I learned it in college, and he had learned it when he was younger, playing with his aunt. But during his university years, he started playing duplicate bridge, which is the competition bridge. Have you heard of duplicate?
Mm. No. Mm-mm.
Well, it's competition bridge for people that like to play it. And to play duplicate, you have to study all the different systems. It's very complicated and very competitive. Well, I had liked it, and so I had done, but I had not studied as much as my husband had. John ended up, when he came to Houston, when you participate in the competitions, you win, you get points, and some of them are called red points when they're at the very high level. That was the system at that time. And if you had so-called 300 points, you were a, quote, life master. John had 290, and I had about 18 or so. So he was very close to being a life master. And he comes in and he starts playing duplicate bridge, and I was playing duplicate bridge. So people started introducing us. And then we had a national tournament here, and in came all the big names like Charles Bourne. You've heard that name, I'm sure. He's number one in the bridge world.
Okay.
And Jacoby is another one. And they knew John from the previous company. They knew me because I'd shown. There weren't that many young women interested in playing duplicate bridge, and they would go. And so they knew me, and so they kept introducing us and saying, you know, you should too. Well, he wouldn't ask me to play, and I would certainly didn't ask him. You didn't ask guys to do things in those days. Anyway, they could be considered asking for a date. That just really wasn't done. So finally, John decided to ask me to play bridge in November. And he was playing with a lady, Stephanie Martin, an older woman. You know, she was all of like maybe 50 years old or something. But she was playing with him because she was trying to get her life master. John was a real good player. So what you do is you get somebody, you play with them a lot, so that then when you play in the big competitions, you have a better chance of winning the competition. And she was trying. And John was playing 4 or 5 times a week. He would play a lot. I would play one time a week. So, I mean, that was a sort of, to give you the difference, the importance of bridge to us at that time. But he finally asked me for a bridge date on Saturday night at the club. But he had bridge date that morning with Stephanie. And he was, or that afternoon, and so she learned that he had a date with me. You got a date with Patsy, and she told him he had to go home and get dressed up to play bridge with me. It was very important how you dressed. And I was, you know, pretty special apparently. So he went home and he got dressed up, and we played bridge. And then after, we drove out to Prince's drive-in and had hamburgers and stuff, and we talked until 4 a.m.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, so Sunday he already had a bridge date to play something or other, but he asked if he could come and, you know, take me out to coffee afterwards or something. And then Monday, and then Tuesday, and then Wednesday. And so finally on Thursday or Friday, my colleagues pulled out the list. I must have been a little starstruck by that time. And he met every qualification on the list. So he proposed on Friday night, and I had my selective hearing on and pretended I didn't hear him. So he repeated the proposal on Saturday night, and I said yes. And on Sunday morning, we called my parents and said, we're coming out to go to church with you. And we went to church, and then we came home, and we're sitting there talking, and Mother is finishing up the roast and stuff, and my dad and I and John, we were like this, and we sat together, and I said, "Daddy, I'm going to marry John." My daddy jumped up, rushed across the room, and shook his hand vigorously, and said he would be delighted to have him as a son-in-law. I think my daddy thought maybe I'd never get married. And my mother came out, you know, and everything. So here we are eating, and I told you how it was, my mother's home was, there was Grand Central. In comes Uncle somebody or other, forgotten which one. First thing my daddy does is tell Patsy's gonna marry. Well, my mother, I could see, like all good mothers, was planning an announcement party and everything in her head. I know she was. She never told me she was, but I know she was. Well, so then we had to go and introduce John to all of my family, my two brothers and all of, and their wives, all of their children, and my two aunts that lived here, and I think I had four uncles. And each one of these, you know, has a wife, or husband, and two or three kids, or four more. And on the way back into town, John knew everybody's name and what the relationship was. He was an unusual person. But that was, so that was a lot of my, what did I do? I went, continued to work, and he continued to work, and his parents were, we were planning our marriage, and his parents were coming down for his birthday on February the 13th, and we decided shortly after the first year that we wanted to go ahead and get married as soon as we could. And since they were already coming down, traveling was, in the 1950s, you know, if you just to travel from Oklahoma to Texas was it's quite a journey. Well, we'll just go ahead and get married while they're here. And so we went ahead and planned. I had got my dress, and I actually ended up wearing my sister-in-law's dress, wedding dress. But I had the dresses made for my two attendants and got everything ready and got the invitations out. And I had a very, very nice formal wedding, and the reception was at my mother's and father's home. And it was very nice. And it rained. But, and so then Chell had a nepotism ruling. So you could not have husband and wife, father and son, father and daughter, brothers, whatever it was, both working for the company, even though we're in two very separate companies and at a very great distance. And so one of us needed to resign. Well, I could get another job, but John didn't think he could get another. And then John was making more money than I was because he had a doctorate. So he was like making, like, I was making 409, so he was making 500 or something like that. A little more. But at any rate, so I had to resign, and because I was forced to resign by company policy, I was eligible to sign up for unemployment benefits. So I did. And I went down. And well, you know, the unemployment office didn't have any jobs for chemical engineers hardly, because we were in very high demand at that time. And but I did the form, and I collected that for a while, and then I started, you know, I was looking around, what do I want to do, where can I go, and everything. And I went out and talked to Professor Kobayashi. We did not have, at that time at the university, most of the bigger universities have facilities now to help their people find jobs when they finish. We didn't have a really huge group of that effort of that at Rice. So talking to the professors was the best way to get it. And so when I talked to him, he told me that he had a plan with Professor Katz of University of Michigan, who had been his, where he had done his doctorate for the book there on the table, Natural Gas Engineering. And he was to do a certain portion of it along with other people who had done their doctorates with Professor Katz. And he wanted me to help him do this because it was a real major. He was a very young professor at that time, of course. And so he needed help to do his portions because it involved a tremendous amount of legwork and picking up all of the references and all. And if you look at the book, you can see that each chapter and section has 30 to 100 references in the back. and each reference is cited in full. It is a complete reference of the journal's name, the volume, the page numbers, the years, all of the authors, and the title of the, that's called a complete citation. You can have a citation that simply says it's in Life magazine and the year, but that's not a complete citation. A complete citation is Life magazine, volume so-and-so, issue so-and-so, and then mae even that July 8th, 2012, or whatever the date may or may have been, and then the title of the article, and then the names of the authors, and sometimes you even put their affiliation, and the specific pages of the journal. And if it's a newspaper citation, you put the page and the column number, because there may be 8 columns on a page. Well, getting all of that detail for every little thing that you have in the book, every little piece of data, was a lot of work, and that was the work that I did, as well as getting the raw information for any particular physical property that we did, or whatever the information was, and taking that information and plotting it on, engineers in those days used graph paper, and it can be either a simple XY graph where equal increments in each direction, or it can be a logarithmic graph, or it can be a log graph, which is logarithmic in both directions. And you plot the information, and then you have to decide what is the common, this is nowadays done with computers, but back when I did it, you plotted it and then you looked at it and you drew the lines. I remember, and just a few years later when I was, well, many years later when I was working with Hudson, when even at that point, and some of the particular information we had, and I had some of the interns, and I showed them how I was plotting, and I would lay it down, and then you would get back and lay it on a table and look at it from the side and decide whether that looked like it was behaving in a continuous fashion, because the idea of a correlation is that things, chemicals, whatever they are properties, behave continuously. This is a basic principle of developing a correlation, and you have to do this. And so we have things called standard, and mathematically this is all now understood in terms of standard deviations and everything, but we didn't have that to apply. And that's the reason you've got all this raw data, and it all looks, but there's one point that's way off someplace. So you have to find out what's wrong with that one point. And that's why I told the graduate students to record the phase of the moon. You've got to be able to go back and find out what's wrong with that one point, so you're justified in ignoring it. So, you'll find the same thing in doing genealogical research.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's just a basic interest. So see, did I wander off of where I was?
Yeah, so I want to hear more about that, but let's go back to Shell for a little bit and then come back to your work with Ricky Kobayashi. So back at Shell, what you referenced something about learning equipment. What kinds of equipment were you using?
I was in a pilot plant. Mm-hmm. A pilot plant is, well, everybody has visions of a chemical laboratory, and the chemical desk with the Erlenmeyer flask and the glass things and all that. That's a lab style. Okay, the next step up is a pilot plant, where you have a bigger scale, usually made of metal, for most of the things that we work with. It's a bigger, larger physical scale of a piece of equipment that you investigate to see if it will work. And then you actually, after that, you build your first trial plant, which is actually full operating size. Envision the Tonka truck, the little toy truck. That's the one on the lab. And then you see the little cars that the little kids are driving up and down the street. That's the next one. And then there's the final car. It's the same thing in chemical engineering. I'm pretty good at analogies.
Yeah, that's helpful for, I think, people who aren't familiar with it like me. So were you was it sort of like a team collaborative effort to
no,
do this?
No, this equipment had actually already been purchased and
okay.
had been installed in the laboratory and put together
okay.
when I came in on the project.
Okay.
You have, and again, you have to, if you're doing this sort of work, you have to have it planned so that if somebody drops out or is not able to do it, that somebody else can come in and take over it. That's an essential part of always have somebody in your back to take over what you're doing.
Mm.
It's part of being an engineer.
Mm.
Back up.
So this was a separation for purification?
It was extraction.
Extraction.
Extraction, yeah.
And yesterday you were describing working with a machinist.
The Podbilniak extractor.
Okay.
Centrifugal. Podbilniak centrifugal extractor. I think it was used in drug preparations more than what we were trying to do for. But my pod extractor was, you know, about this big. And the full-size operating equipment, of course, would have been a 10 or 16-foot diameter.
And what was the objective?
We're going back. I'm trying to remember the details. You took the lubricating oil and you, that fraction that had that in it, and you contacted it with another chemical that then extracted the lighter ends from the oil. I think that's what it did.
And were you trying to get higher efficiency, or was this a new installation?
Oh, well, no, it was. Trying to describe extraction in words. It's you have the chemical reaction going on between the components, and if you do it in stages, this stage purifies it this much, this one does it this much, this one, so, and that's the principle of the extraction stages, just like in distillation. Does that help?
Yeah. So you were trying to.
You were trying to get the multiple stage extraction going on. It's like it's like a filter press where you have multiple stage filtration.
Hmm.
Generally speaking, when you're purifying something, you've got imagine a big mess of rocks. They're multiple sizes. So you put them into a great big sieve that has great big holes in it. So the great rocks are gonna be caught on the great holes.
Hmm.
Okay. Then you still got a mixture down here. The next mixture you put on one, instead of having a great hole, you have a large hole. So all the great rocks go into that one. And then you go into the large, all the remainder, and then you put the larger one where you have a medium large. And then you have a filter that, and you separate by stages until the rocks, and you end up finally with the fine sand and then dust at the very end. But at the very top, you've got a great, great big things. So what you're doing, essentially, in all of the separation processes that we have, is you're doing something to make them separate. And to make them separate, you either use their physical size, their physical density, their physical affinity for another compound, and that's what separation processes are. And that's a basic, in fact, that's one of the courses that we probably take is separation processes. I vaguely remember something called that.
Was the intent that someone once thought this could be commercialized as a more efficient?
Shell at that time, the particular extraction process that you use, there's a lot of considerations. Some of them are patented, so that you have a, you must have run into this in your work also. You may have a patent for a particular process, so that every time somebody uses it, you've got to pay them a fee. So perhaps it was that. I don't know the motivation behind this particular investigation. But I do know that different people have different... I'm going to use an example. There was a man in my group who had, his specialty was the waxes, which is another piece of the heavies, ends, it's in the lubricating oil. And he worked on waxes and had been working on it for 30 years. And he had an idea of something to do in treating the waxes, which I don't remember at all. And somehow or other, he got a break in his assigned duties, and he could go off and do what he wanted to do. And he went off and investigated this, you know, at the company, on company time, but you know, he really wasn't officially assigned to do this. And he developed something that saved the company thousands and thousands of dollars in doing this research of his own volition, using what he had learned and known. So if you kind of leave people alone a while, they sometimes can produce some very amazing things.
So I'm reflecting on a newly graduated engineer starting this job, probably younger than a lot of people.
Oh, that really impressed me. It really did. That was, of the years, in those few months I was there, I think that was the most significant thing that happened, was this man being able to go on and work on his own and come up with something that was so tremendously beneficial to the company. And I mean, what he did essentially paid for the operation of the group that I was with for years. It was truly amazing.
So as a woman, what were you wearing in this workplace?
I wore pants, pants suits, I think, mainly, is what I wore. Because I wasn't, you know, we did have ladders that we went up and down because you went on other people's equipment and stuff, and you had to be prepared to go out if something happened to you. So yeah, I wore pants.
And were you wearing like closed-toed shoes, I imagine?
Oh yes, always mm-hmm. closed, yes. I did not wear steel-toed.
Okay.
But I did wear clothes, shoes, and pants. Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about, you called it, Shell had this nepotism rule. It sounded like it was related to any family members.
Yes,
was this a known thing, or how did that make you feel?
Well, I guess I wasn't even aware of it until I got married. I think the reason Shell had it, they weren't the only company to have it. Many, many companies had that, thinking that if you've got your relative, you're going to favor them. Mm-hmm. And it's probably true. I mean, I can see it happen. Or maybe you disfavor them. It could work both ways. There's some companies that actively promoted having family members work for them. And this was just the way. Today we have our OSHA rules and things, or historically, if you go through, that's another whole field for you to look into as a historian, the history of workforce, we've all heard about the people in the sewing industry where they worked until they ruined their eyes and stuff. And it's employment conditions change with society. That's all I can say. Yeah. It's just another interesting aspect of our history.
And you mentioned being the only woman in this engineering group. How did that go? Were there other women in other parts of the company that you interacted with? So two questions. What were your interactions like as a woman with the men around you? And then also, were you interacting with women in other parts of the company?
Not really. I mean, there were most of the secretarial positions were held by women, mm-hmm. if not all. The librarian type of thing. So much of a refinery is physical, that they're mostly women. They're mostly women in the non-physical things. So most of the stuff is physical, so most of them are men. I don't really recall any other particular women interactions that I had. Which is quite interesting. I have a first cousin. She's about 10 years younger than I am. And just a few years later, like 20 years later, maybe 15 years later, she went to work for Exxon as an operator in their refinery in Baytown. Ended up being, you know, head operator. She actually, you know, was the one that went out and operated the equipment. But when I started in the 50s, that was not possible.
And had, you know, I know you ended up leaving, but did you, could you see like a future long-term ways in which you could advance in Shell?
Oh, I think I would have advanced very well in Shell. Mm-hmm. Shell is an international company, and the prejudice against women was not nearly as strong in Europe as it was in the United States. That was my experience. Mm-hmm. And I had no doubt that I could, you know, advance with Shell, mm-hmm. and would have.
Did you ever travel while working at Shell?
No, not in that 6 month period.
Okay. And then I was also wondering, I think you had said that there may have been somebody else or multiple people from Rice who went to Shell. Did you know other people who also were working there?
No, not at Rice. Not at Shell.
Okay.
A lot of people went to work for the engineering company that I ended up with.
Okay.
That's where you got the idea.
Okay. That makes sense.
So you talked about meeting John, which is fascinating, but the timeline. So it was just a matter of a week or two? Is that what I...
We dated 1 week before we were engaged, and that was in early December, and then we were married on Valentine's Day. And we were married 63 years.
So was this a love at first sight, practically?
Well, we talked till 4 a.m., I guess so. It's pretty obvious that he was the one for me and I was the one for him. We blended together very, very well.
Did you realize he met those 30 criteria that...
Oh, yes, they had pulled the list out on Thursday, my colleagues had, because I was pretty starry-eyed that week. And he arranged... He had a bunch of bridge dates already outlined, and he speedily rearranged all of them so that he could see me every day that week. I mean, we really fell pretty hard for each other. It's pretty obvious, I think, that it does happen. When you finally find somebody that's your real soulmate, whatever the attraction is, it's you know it. I don't know. That's what I had. I was very fortunate.
Sometimes they would say for technical people, you know, get with someone non-technical, but... Sometimes they say they understand you better if you get with someone technical.
Well, no. John and I complimented each other. He was a very brilliant theoretical physicist. His thesis, I can show it to you, the photoproduction of mesons in deuterium. It's about a quarter of an inch thick. And it reads, if... Then he had to write in his equations by hand in those days. Then there's another squiggle, squiggle, squiggle. It is obvious that, squiggle, squiggle, squiggle. And it goes through, you know, maybe 20 pages of this, and that's the thesis. You would be able to look at, and literally, you know, you can read the words, but all of the rest of it is in very high mathematical formulations, and it looks like squiggle, squiggle, squiggle to most people. And it was verified experimentally some 10 years after he did this theoretical investigation. He then went to work for Shell at the Shell Development. I got to talk about my husband. And his first assignment was in the field of catalysis. And what he did, I guess they did it with everybody. They gave you some sort of a little project to do to see if you can really work. That's what mine was. Looking back, I can realize that. They knew it wasn't going to work. Well, let's see if she can find out. Well, he was assigned something in catalysis, and it wasn't particularly a lot of money for the company, so he got to publish it. So his first technical publication that was not based on his thesis, he had one on that, of course, was in the field of catalysis in a chemical engineering journal. Then he was assigned to work on offshore waves and their force. And if you will Google the Chapelier theory, you will find that John E. Chapelier was the one who developed the Chapelier theory. And then more interesting, along many years later, we have our daughter who goes off to Texas A&M University and decides to study ocean engineering. And she gets in one of her advanced classes, and the professor, first day of class, is calling the roll to see who's in his class. That's what they usually did, just to learn, and he gets to Chapelier June and calls her name and looks at her and says, "Chapelier, do you know John E. Chapelier by any chance? He's my father. I did my thesis on the Chapelier theory." This really happened, and of course he wanted to get in, so John went up and gave a talk to the class. And I didn't know about this until my husband died. I did not know that John had developed the Chapelier wave theory until he died. He never made
it. You found a document, or your
daughter? I found out about it after June told me this, and I found out about it after he died. Yeah.
Wow. So
it
just
was very mild, but working together, we talked about. Ours was an unusual marriage. It really was, because, I mean, don't forget, John grew up in the same area that I did, where the women had all the same influences, except his family. He was an only child. They were buying their own home during the Depression. His father sold insurance, so they had a very small but steady income, but unlike what I had. So he never had a lot of the insecurity that I had, which I didn't know I had going up. But nevertheless, he had a lot of the same influences social-wise that we did. Yet he always accepted me as an equal. He always had something advice for people. He said that a good marriage is based on mutual respect. And he respected me, and I respected him. And we did technical things together, too, during the years. He would come up, when I was working at Rice with Kobayashi in the subsequent year, I would take my lunch with me, because to go to eat, I would have had to go across campus, and I really didn't want to spend the money. You know, we had four little kids at home that we needed to have the money for, and four children take a lot of money. And I didn't want to pay when I could make my lunch and eat for 20% of what I would have to pay for buying it at the faculty club. So I would have that. And then also, Rice and John's laboratory were very close to each other. So you could drive from one to the other in about 5 to 10 minutes, depending on the traffic. And so John would come over, I would pack lunch for both of us, and he would come over, and we would eat lunch in my office. I had a small office there, and we would eat lunch together and talk about, you know, we could have adult talk instead of children talk, because when you went home, you had all this little mob of little ones around until you could get them fed and into bed, and then by that time, you were too tired to talk. And then we would talk about what we were doing, and at times, I would have something that we were doing in research that I didn't understand or couldn't, and I would talk to him about it, and he would have the ideas, and he would talk to me about his work. And I think I told you this last night, but one day we had some sort of a problem, and he sat down and did the mathematics for it on the, you know, piece of paper for me, and because his math was a lot better than mine as far as proving if this, then that. And so he helped me, and then when he went from the wave theory, he went into reservoir simulation, where they made the computer models of how the oil is, the crude petroleum, is behaving down in the ground, and that's called a reservoir. And they have modeled mathematical models nowadays of what that is and how it behaves, and that's what they use to plan all of their production with. And John worked on that for the majority of his career with Shell. He was in reservoir modeling. Well, they started off, they only considered one phase. A phase is vapor or gas or liquid or solid or a colloidal solution. And they considered it was just one homogeneous phase that they really didn't know what was. And they finally realized that they had to consider the fact that it did have these different phases existing in the reservoir, and they had to consider that. And so I introduced him to, in chemical engineering, we call it Gibbs phase rule. Depending upon how many components you have and what the pressures and temperatures are, will determine how many phases you have. In that bottle of my first production crude oil there, you see there is a lot of liquid, but above that liquid, trapped behind, underneath that cap, is a gas phase. And depending upon the pressure and temperature is what that will be. That's the simplest expression I can give for what phase behavior is. But that, I spent a lot of my career working on phase behavior. Came off topic now.
Well, this is, it's all really interesting, so it's good to cover. I had another question about rice, which related to something you said yesterday. Shell oil.
Sure.
I believe you said, I know you talked about newspaper coverage when you were using your high heel to nail something in. Was that a shell?
And that was a shell.
Okay,
yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about
that? I didn't realize what was going on at the time, frankly. you know, that they were exploiting me for being a woman. Like I say, I was pretty naive. Looking back, most women at age 20 or 21 are pretty naive. they were using me to promote. But don't forget, there was tremendous government pressure starting at that time to integrate women into the workforce in all directions. So that was going on. So it was a product of the, what you do and see, and how you are a product of what's going on at the time in all of society, and it affects what you're doing. And you're nodding your head, yes, yes, yes. That's what it was.
And as a point of clarification, you weren't wearing high-heeled shoes during the work day,
no,
right?
Of course not.
Okay, just to check.
No, but when I went to the, AICHE is American Institute of Chemical Engineers, and that's our professional society. If I went to a meeting of that, mm-hmm. I would dress in heels and hose, and maybe not high heels, but I mean heels of mm-hmm. some sort, and hose, and I don't think I wore a hat and gloves, as I recall, ever to AICHE meetings. No, I don't think I ever did that. I'm quite sure that Dr. Gilbreth, when she first started participating, did. But of course, her career was 20 years prior to mine.
Mm-hmm. It was the accepted dress of the day.
It was the accepted dress of the day. Mm-hmm. My mother would no more have thought in the 1940s of attending church without wearing a hat and gloves. I mean, that just wasn't done. I can't, for a lady to do that. And in fact, we still have a little bit of that on Easter Sunday when people dress up their little girls and they put a hat and a purse on them. Mm-hmm. It's still a little residual things about that.
So when did you first get involved with AICHE?
Well, the first thing I did as far as professional involvement goes was join the Society of Women Engineers. And I did that immediately after we got married, or when we got married, right around that same time. And I was active in SWE through about 1960, I think it was, when I joined AICHE. And I decided at that time that I could further my own career better if I stayed in my particular profession rather than the general idea of approaching it as a woman in a man's position. Profession, to approach it as an engineer in an engineering profession, specifically chemical engineering. And that was my main motivation for changing.
and I was very, very active in AICHE.
Well, for a long time. Not so terribly when my... Well, I attended the local section meetings for many, many years. And at that time, we had... I was working at Rice. I didn't hold any local section offices. I guess I was a judge for the science fair participants, some of the early activities in AICHE. And we had one meeting that alternated. The spring meeting alternated, and I can't put exact dates on this, between New Orleans and Houston. And that must have been in the 60s. So because of doing the research that I was doing in the field of thermodynamics, there was always a session on thermodynamics. And I always attended those sessions at those meetings. And it was the same people every time. All the black cats get together and all the white cats get together, that sort of thing. But the one time we had a meeting and we were down at the Rice Hotel at one of the cocktail receptions. And we got out on the balcony talking and decided that the programming of AICHE wasn't really meeting our needs for doing the fundamental research and basic thermodynamics that needed to be done in order to develop better handling of gas and oil production and processing. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to form a division, and it was called the Fuels and Petrochemicals Division, and that was the first division of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers. This is part of the history of the Institute that may not be well known. But and then we started putting a lot of pressure and actually on the programming and changed the programming quite a bit by that. Subsequent to that time in the history of the Institute, we have developed several other divisions, and we now have about 9 or so. One is safety, and one is, I can't even remember all of the different names. It's on our dues list each time, but you know, you can, whatever particular aspect, you can be active in that one. One is in the biomedical field, I think. Do you remember any others?
There was management division.
Management,
as well.
That's one, yes.
But there's catalysis.
And catalysis, yes. And
so that's pretty groundbreaking to...
We were the first.
Yeah.
I've been in a lot of firsts in my life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, that was the first. I was the first fellow female. And
I think it's one of the largest divisions.
Safety, I think, is the other big one. Mm-hmm. Safety something or other. I can't even remember what their proper title is. But, again, it's chemical engineering is very... encompasses so large an amount of interest and abilities, and new ones spring up all the time. So it's not surprising that it came up. But anyway, I became active in forming this division. I was one of the founding officers. I think I was first. We started off having secretary treasurer as one office, and we split that off. So I was helped write all the constitution and bylaws. Remember, I told you I did that for Shelley Rice Literary Society. I've done a lot of that in my life. And then after being secretary treasurer, then I became a director, and then I became vice president, and then vice chairman, and then I became chairman of the division. And I've got various and sundry pictures and stuff, and a big plaque. I'll have to show you my brag wall, but you're right. And then after that, this is over many years. After I was working with the engineering company, I was asked to run for director, and first I couldn't get permission from the company to pay for me to be a director, because to be even as the head of a major division, I had to do traveling for that particular purpose, but not nearly as involved as if you are a national officer. Most of my activity had been locally here in Houston for the annual meeting that we held, of the National Society here. The National Society holds 4 meetings a year, one of which is the annual meeting, but the other 3 are in different geographic locations, and where they're held there's a whole litany of reasons as to why they're held at the same place or in alternate places, like I said, Houston and New Orleans. Houston and New Orleans was the oil and gas industry. And it was big enough in chemical engineering that it deserved one meeting a year. But it was not the national meeting. The national meeting goes for more of a resort type location, resort being New York City for one, or California, or Philadelphia. That's places where the national meetings are held, and those are held in November, I think it is.
So it sounded like you got support from
Rice. Well, when I was the director, because of having our meetings in Houston and New Orleans, at Rice, I attended the AICHE meetings with Kobayashi, because we would give papers or chair sessions or manage registration or something for those. And then, so those meetings were, New Orleans is kind of local. I mean, you get in a car and you drive over there. But then I was very, very active while I was at the university, working at the university, in the natural gas processors efforts, which is headed out of Tulsa. And that's specifically with processing of natural gas, which much of our work with Kobayashi and Leland was associated with that particular type of processing. That was a major portion of my career. This is all kind of jumbled together. It's hard to understand. Try to keep it straight.
And so, as in your leadership of AICHE, what were some of your, I know you talked about the goals of creating that fuels and petrochemicals division, but what were some of your goals in your leadership roles? What were you trying to do, and how were you trying to influence or change or run the organization?
The biggest thing we were concerned with was programming. And programming, getting space on your program, and because you're competing with somebody else that wants to go over here and talk about catalysis or wants to talk about safety, and you're all competing for so many meeting. Each specific meeting room has so many meeting rooms, and they can only handle so much, and there's limitations. So it's competition, and we were competing for meetings and meeting spaces and program, because to develop any particular program, and all of this is done by professionals. You don't do it during work time. It's additional time that you spend doing this type of thing. And it's very, time consuming to be active in a professional organization.
Mm-hmm.
It's time consuming to be active in any organization.
So what was the kind of inherent benefit, I guess, you felt from putting in all that extra time?
it made you able to spend time with people doing similar research and to see what they're doing and to get a report of what they're doing, and you get an idea of a new way to look at your own research. I found that very true in going back to genealogy again, but anytime I go to a genealogy meeting and hear a speaker on whatever topic it may be, I will get an idea of a new way of looking for information, because you're trying to dig up ancient history and dig up knowledge that isn't. It's out there, but you don't know where to go to look for it. And I get an idea of where to look for it. And in doing basic research, which is what I was doing, a lot of that same thing happens. And the actual, just sitting down and chewing the fat, so to speak. One night, Ricky was sitting down at a garden conference. A garden conference, do you know what a garden conference is?
I've heard of them, but
okay,
feel free to explain.
Put a definition in there of what they are.
Uh-huh.
At any rate, Ricky was sitting and talking with Linus Pauling, and they were talking about the gas hydrate lattice and what it was. Well, in doing the work I'd done with Kobayashi, I had actually made a model. He had made the molecular models you've all seen, I'm sure, where you have little balls and sticks and stuff that they... Well, Ricky took the little ball and drilled the little angles and sawed all the little sticks, and I measured them very carefully and marked them off and glued them together and made these models, and the models are, 2 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet. Had to show the way that the structure exists, which is a very complex structure. And I actually used fingernail polish to mark the packing points on the one of them. I went in with string and did the cubic, defined what the cubic repeating block was of the structure, and the other one is on a packing point thing. And so I did the painted the packing points with red nail polish so that they showed up, so that you could see them in this maze of balls. Very interesting. But the angle is the tetrahedral angle that occurs in there is 106.5 degrees, and they wanted to know what this number was. And Ricky calls me in the middle of the night and asks me what it was. Unfortunately, I did remember it. But that sort of thing, the garden conference promoted people getting together and sitting and talking like that, and that promotes the knowledge of science. And the same thing is beneficial in participation in a professional society. And I see Gail is nodding her head vigorously at this.
Yes.
I
have similar experience. So did you find some of those dialogues, those serendipitous conversations, harder as a woman, or people, you just found the right technical language with everybody?
I never had any problems at all as a woman. Never. In those types of situations. No.
Did you hear of any others that did?
No, I can't say that I did. Not in those situations.
And
again, it's a matter of respect. If you're dealing with something and you have proven that you have the respect for your ability, and you're dealing with people who have respect for their own ability and respect for yours, there's not any problems. The problems comes when there's not respect and there's not ability.
In your involvement in the AICFG over time, did you feel that did you get to know people in the field? Did you feel part of the field?
I knew everybody who was anybody in the field of thermodynamics in the United States and worldwide, and they knew who I was. Mm. And I wasn't aware of that until we spent the year abroad, but I knew everybody who was anybody. Yes. Mm.
mean, how was that validating for you at that point in time in Europe to sort of go, okay, I really am preeminent here in terms of connection?
Yeah, I had going to Europe was a major change in my life, yes. And it was part of why I left the university.
Okay. Yeah. So I think, why don't we take a break at this point?
Okay, good.